Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
The third part of our plan is to provide the infusion of capital necessary to catalyze our innovation economy. We will propose a stem cell and innovation fund led by Lieutenant Governor David Patterson.
Governor Spitzer from his State of the State as we continue to digest his hour-long laundry list of proposals for reform. We'll talk about two more of them now, putting a stem cell research funding initiative to the voters of New York and putting an end to gerrymandering. Stem cells first.
The fund will provide long-term investment overseen by independent industry experts for stem cell innovations and other types of applied research that will lead to direct commercial application. This investment will repay itself many times over in increased jobs, economic activity, and improved health.
So the governor is proposing not just a law, but a funding mechanism that we the voters, will have to approve. Let's talk about it. Funding that the voters will have to vote on with respect to stem cells, and because it's stem cells, it's going to be a hot-button issue for reasons other than fiscal ones. Let's talk about it and where this fits into the national picture as well. Remember, Nancy Pelosi has made stem cell funding part of her 100 hours agenda as she starts out, too. And with me for this are Dr. Ivan Oransky, deputy editor of The Scientist magazine, and Michael Waldman, executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, former speechwriter for President Clinton, and he's been working on a lot of the government reform aspects, at least studying them, of the Spitzer agenda. And Michael Waldman, welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure.
Have you actually been working with the governor on any of this?
A little bit. The Brennan Center, of course, over many years has been studying the problems of New York State government and proposing solutions. And over the last month or so, I was privileged to be part of his transition team. There was an outside committee of basically outsiders that made recommendations.
Good. So you'll be well.
It officially disbanded as soon as we were done meeting.
Still, you'll be well placed to explain some of this to us. And Dr. Oransky, New York is hardly the only state trying to use stem cell research as economic development. Can you put New York in context for us?
Absolutely. You know, every state almost, it seems, is trying to put together something, whether it's economic, whether it's an actual bond issue, as we know in California. And there are varying levels of success. I think that everyone kind of dropped everything they were doing 2 years ago when California came out with this massive bond issue, as you know, a $3 billion bond issue over 10 years. Excuse me.
Did it pass?
It did pass 2 years ago. However, no one's seen a dime of that money yet. It's been so tied up in litigation, all kinds of protests, some ethical issues, not just the stem cell work itself, but some of the conflict of interest issues that surround this. It's calling it a miasma, I think, would be pretty fair.
And I think it's not just California. Just in our region, Governor Corzine in New Jersey has proposed a stem cell research institute, and I think Connecticut is doing something, too.
Governor Rell has also, I think it was $150 million, but that number may not be correct. But there's a lot of interest right here in the area, and there's almost been a talk of an Eastern stem cell hub. I mean, if you look at the power you have in New York, New Jersey, maybe Pennsylvania, but also Connecticut. Certainly lots of academic institutions, and each state brings something different to the table. And I think that if I were to guess, what Governor Spitzer's trying to say here is that, hey, New York can bring the money to the table. You know, what do you guys got?
So, Michael Waldman, it's funny in a way because we usually hear about stem cell research in the context of medical and moral issues. But Spitzer, and now we're learning these other states' governors, have placed it in the context of economic development.
Well, I think that a lot of states looking at economic development have looked at times when government investment in science have led to long-term economic gains, whether it's the internet through DARPA, the Defense Department spending, or the highway system and the Sputnik response in the 1950s leading to a lot of scientific advances. And the politicians aren't scientists, but they can read their memos enough to know that, that in this century, a lot of people feel that biomedical advances will be where a lot of the growth is going to come. And of course, it, as you say, it has been bound up in some of the political controversies over stem cell from the religious right. But other than that, it has actually proven to be, as a political matter, pretty non-controversial. Of course, the question is whether investing money like this actually gets you the progress you want, or if it turns out to just be money spent but not results.
Do you think it clouds the moral issue if states have economic incentives to promote stem cell research and not just medical ones?
Well, it's a thumb on the scale, certainly, but I think that the moral issues stand on their own, and underlying all of it is whether or not the breakthroughs in science, in fact, can improve people's health the way that I, at least as a total non-expert, have been led to believe is the case. If this is really something that can lead to a massive improvement in people's health, I think states are looking for this kind of post-industrial, post-manufacturing industry. And so if it really works, it's a win-win for everybody concerned.
Michael Waldman from the Brennan Center for Justice and a member of Elliot Spitzer's transition team, as he told us, and Dr. Ivan Oransky, deputy editor of The Scientist magazine. And Dr. Oransky, your magazine reported on a related issue. A lot of the funding for stem cell research, maybe that's the federal funding, may go to the state of Wisconsin because the state of Wisconsin owns the patents on what, stem cell lines?
They own this incredibly broad patent, and I think it's 806. You always refer to patents by the last three digits because they're such long numbers. This is being challenged right now, and we'd heard rumblings about it from people in California who suddenly realized, after all this money supposedly was going to become available, that in fact they would have to pay such large royalties to what's really the state of Wisconsin. It's the Wisconsin Alumni Research Fund, quite a powerful group, and this is University of Wisconsin Research that came up with the technique, if you will, to actually create stem cell lines. It's being challenged. The patent office has agreed to review it, which generally means, can't predict it, I'm certainly not a legal expert, but generally means that something's going to change in the patent. It's not going to be thrown out, but probably it's going to be pulled back. In the meantime, these are pretty massive amounts. And when you think politically, okay, well, California says $3 billion and Elliot Spitzer says $2 billion and this one says the other thing. When a good chunk of that's going to another state, I'm not sure that's as politically interesting.
So you mean if the voters of New York State approve a stem cell research bond issue, that some chunk of that money, unless the patent is rescinded, is going to have to go to Wisconsin?
Correct. That's exactly right.
How much? Can you tell?
It's hard to say. Again, these things are negotiated. If it's a massive company that says, look, we can give you lots of downstream opportunities and things like this, it gets quite complex. But, you're talking about a researcher having to pay maybe a few hundred thousand dollars and even more for, just a single use of this patent. Well, that can add up.
That's pretty interesting. And Michael Waldman, I guess this is the first I'm hearing of it, but maybe this is going to break out in any campaign for and against a stem cell bond issue as a point of debate.
Well, one of the ways in which it's interesting is that you have this sort of strange system in this country where we have 50 states and they do their own economic development policy, even though often it's regional or national in scope that ought to be the focus. And in the case of stem cell, the reason that states have stepped in part is because federal action has been stymied by President Bush, who has a very specific and some would say very doctrinaire position, so that the states have rushed in. And that doesn't mean it's not wise for the states to rush in, but it is the kind of thing that in other countries, it's not the the province of Saxony that is doing the German stem cell
right.
initiative is the German government.
I hear what you're saying. So if back in his 2001 stem cell policy decree, Dr. Aransky, if President Bush had been more permissive in what the federal government is willing to fund, then this wouldn't be happening with all these states rushing in?
I think that's a pretty, you know, we can sort of create some historical counterfactuals and get all fancy, but I think that that's a fair comment. And I think that that's really what happened. If you look at the timeline, it just makes sense. You know, there are a lot of people, and this is not to sort of compare the administrations anyway, but a lot of people say, well, Clinton didn't fund stem cell research at all. Actually, the Bush administration, it's a piddling amount. I think it's on the order of $10 million, actually started to, I think you can sort of call them both basically non-backers of stem cell research. What's interesting, though, is if you look at today's Congress, of course, you're seeing a complete change. Their political people know far more than I do about these issues. I'm kind of the science expert here. But we're really one vote away in the Senate from overturning a veto, if you look carefully at the numbers, in terms of what people have said publicly. So,
and in fact, as I said before, it is one of Nancy Pelosi's first 100 hours, first six items that she's intending to deal with. So they're at least going to give the president another chance to veto a stem cell funding bill. But Michael Waldman, what happens if that bill does go through and the president does sign it, or even they have enough votes to override a veto perhaps? Does that counteract what Elliot Spitzer is planning for New York State?
Of course, I don't know the details and the to fully answer that, and the details, of course, haven't been spelled out. But I think that this is something that I'm guessing New York State would want almost regardless of what other places do. As you know, one of the great challenges for Spitzer and for anybody in New York State is what to do about the economy. It is downstate. The economy is robust, but it's very dependent on what they call FIRE, for finance and insurance and real estate. And upstate, of course, the economy is, as everybody knows, is really in bad shape. And the trends that have buffeted the New York economy are the same kinds of trends, especially upstate, that hit the whole industrial Midwest over the last 30, 40 years, the big factory jobs that are no longer there that are elsewhere. And so it makes a lot of sense for a state with the intellectual resources of New York to look for things like this as a way to move forward, and for things that are public-private partnerships and can leverage university resources and that sort of thing. That's kind of the cutting edge in how states do economic development.
So I wonder, Dr. Aransky, if we're not better off with the system that we have that has devolved to the states. You know, maybe with the president putting the squeeze on federal funding, then states that do have moral objections don't have to do it. Utah doesn't have to set up a stem cell funding initiative. Alabama doesn't have to do it, wherever they are. And places like New York State that, you know, want to revitalize the upstate economy have an opportunity and, I guess, a political incentive, because then it's not only economic development, but it's like in-your-face Republicans, which would be a popular thing around here.
You probably have a point. I think that if you were to talk to scientists, which I do all the time, they would say, well, rising tide, you know, lifts all boats. So let's just throw more money at all kinds of research. And I think, in fact, what would be ideal from a scientist point of view, and probably from sort of a global point of view in terms of commercialization as well, is to have both streams. Because, and that's not necessarily more money, it's just both streams. The streams actually have very different goals. Federal funding is really not about commercialization. There are people who argue it should be more so, and I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but it's really about basic science research. NIH is not particularly interested, maybe they should be, in commercializing products. On the other hand, Elliot Spitzer is quite clear, as he made it so in his inaugural. He's been quite clear, and states think a little bit more about a business. And so you can imagine a sort of NIH funding some of the basic science, the states, whether it's New York, whether it's a conglomeration of states, funding more commercial applications, and really feeding off of each other. I think this is an important thing.
Opponents of embryonic stem cell research, as you know, say adult stem cell research has actually shown more promise based on actual results in the lab. How true is that from your vantage point as a scientist and science writer?
The quick answer is, of course it has, because it's been allowed to flourish and go forward. It's a bit like saying, look, I won the election because I, you know, kept all the people who didn't want to vote for me at home. I don't want to come down either way. Sort of, it's not really an adult versus embryonic debate to me. There's a very interesting company, actually, that happens to be here in New York, run by a guy named Michael Cohen, and it's called National Stem Cell. And they're actually looking at what might be considered, if you will, one of these alternatives that's both scientifically valid and useful, as well as ethically palatable. And that's looking really very carefully at cord blood. In other words, stem cells that are taken from the cord blood. You're quite close to the embryonic stage, and yet there's no ethical issue, really. There's some other issues. But so there are some strengths here that sort of gets to the idea that there are some strengths here in New York. But I think that once embryonic stem cells are allowed to sort of flourish in the lab and research is allowed to, you're going to see a lot of things. You're not going to see everything people are promising, I think.
We're not going to have a cure for Parkinson's disease and diabetes in 2 years.
Well, you know, we've been promised cures for things in 2 years before, and no.
But this
quite.
Leads me to another question, again, for you as a science writer. Is it possible that because of the political incentive to fund stem cell research for New York and other states to make the point that, hey, the federal government has been, you know, hijacked by Christian fundamentalists and we're not them, or however they want to put it, that too much money is going to stem cell research now compared to other kinds of medical research that could also get funded but that don't have the political benefit?
Gee, it's almost like you set me up for that question, Brian. I think that there's so many important issues in medical research. I mean, heart disease still kills more people in this country, men and women, than anything else does. And it's not clear to me that, you know, stem cells are going to be the answer for that. On the other hand, I went out to Minneapolis and actually watched somebody get stem cells, adult stem cells, injected right into his heart for a piece I did in October. So it's certainly moving forward in that direction. But, you know, research funding waxes and wanes. Nixon declared a war on cancer, and all of a sudden every NIH grant in the early 1970s had the word cancer in it. You can make anything sound
right.
like a stem cell
and,
research.
And so I wonder what the economic potential actually is for upstate development. Will this take a lot of taxpayer dollars for a lot of years before it leads to any actual money-making results?
I think that that's really the question. I think there are a lot of – you have to think about the sort of – not add-on, but the sort of parallel streams of biotechnology that happen. And I think that from what I can gather, Spitzer has thought very carefully about this. I understand that he's really studying – he's talked a lot about in his campaign about the Ireland model, and I understand he's studying that. And really, you can't just think about – stem cells, it's almost like – I don't want to call them the lost leader, but it's kind of the thing that you see. But below the surface, there's a sort of iceberg effect where there's all this other stuff happening. Because in order to create stem cells, in order to develop them, manufacture whatever you have to manufacture along with them, you're going to need a lot of manufacturing, a lot of infrastructure.
Dr. Ivan Oransky is deputy editor of The Scientist magazine. Thanks a lot for coming on. That was really informative.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be here.
Michael Waldman from the Brennan Center and the Spitzer Transition Team is going to stay with us as we go to another detail from Spitzer's long laundry list for reform, taking the politics out of redistricting. And the implications of this are so huge. Stay with us.
We will submit legislation that reforms our elections, specifically legislation that establishes an independent, nonpartisan redistricting commission. Until this happens, I will veto any proposal that reflects partisan gerrymandering. More competitive elections will lead to a more responsive government.
Again, Governor Spitzer and another of his initiatives, electoral reform, and as he said in that clip from the State of the State, redistricting reform. And if this sounds boring and technical, realize that the way political districts are drawn for state legislators and members of Congress is considered one of the main reasons for the entrenched political interests keeping power in Albany and for the increasing partisanship in Washington and around the country. And Governor Schwarzenegger in California, who we just talked about with respect to stem cells, also tried to take this issue on in his state and found opposition so intense his attempt at cleaner redistricting failed. So can the sheriff of Wall Street turn sheriff of New York State do any better? We will talk about this now with Michael Wallman, executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. This is one of his particular interests. And again, Michael Wallman was on the Spitzer transition team to help advise on issues like this. So, Michael Wallman, how do we draw district lines in New York State now?
Well, this was a pretty gutsy thing for him to take on. And you're right that it is something that the people in politics know is as big a deal as it's possible to get. Right now, New York's lines are drawn, in effect, by a negotiation between the leaders of the Democrats and the leaders of the Republicans in the Assembly and the Senate. There is a commission that advises on how the lines should be, but in fact, unlike in some states, but the way it is in most states, New York draws its lines through the political process. And of course, the main problem with that is that the people who are drawing the lines have a self-interest in exactly how the lines are drawn. And, you know, it's an interesting challenge because, of course, the issue of gerrymandering, it goes back to the very beginning of the country. And your listeners probably know that the phrase comes from a district that was drawn by Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry that looked like a salamander, and so they called it a gerrymander, and he was one of the founding fathers. And the first actual congressional gerrymandering that people know about is that Patrick Henry tried to draw a legislative district to gerrymander James Madison out of winning his seat. So it's not exactly like this is something that people discovered last week, but it's gotten worse.
Yeah, he was famous for saying, give me a pro-Henry constituency or give me death, wasn't it?
Exactly. Well, in the late 1800s, when Tammany Hall was battling the reformers, they used to kind of draw the legislative districts around people's houses, so that to keep people out of the districts, and that kind of thing, of course, still happens
right now.
It's gotten worse all over the country, and it's gotten worse in New York, and partly just because people are sophisticated and have computers now to do things that used to be. There maybe be a political genius.
So they can really draw those districts so that they are incumbent protection plans if it's the incumbent legislators of the two parties who are making their deals on how to draw the lines.
That's right. With this, with campaign finance, with a lot of issues, of course, the party loyalty to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party sometimes isn't as powerful as the party loyalty to the incumbency party. And so a lot of people have looked at the New York State legislature and seen real problems here. And one of the solutions, and this is what Spitzer was talking about, is to, in effect, take the task of drawing the lines out of the hands of people who have a self-interest and putting it in the hands of a commission of some sort that would be disinterested but would have to meet some standards. There's legislation in the Assembly that Assemblyman Gianaris from Queens has proposed. And this is the right approach. It's very hard to actually do it in the right way. And it really this is something where God or the devil or somewhere in between is in the details.
Well, and it's hard to determine, I think, even what the right way is. I wonder what the standards are or what you think they should be, because there are all kinds of interests in drawing districts. Look at the Voting Rights Act, for example, which just about mandated gerrymandering so that there would be more minority representation in Congress. I'm sure you would consider that a good thing, but that's something than other than just, you know, drawing up the map into little squares and saying this is how we draw the districts.
That's right. One of the goals is competitiveness, making it so that you don't just have Republican lawmakers being in districts where Republicans are going to always win and Democratic lawmakers in districts where Democrats are going to always win. Another goal, which has to be weighed in also, exactly as you say, is diversity and is embodied in the Voting Rights Act, but it really goes beyond that. It's important that whatever redistricting reforms are created don't wind up inadvertently undoing a lot of the progress in terms of the makeup of legislatures. Although it's important to know, too, that legislators from ethnic minority communities can also think like incumbents more than anybody else. And so it's also important to kind of hear those claims, remembering that not everything is entirely divorced, right, even from political self-interest there. But it's very, you're not going to have the political support for redistricting reform unless people feel confident that those kind of protections for minority voting rights are protected. And you're right that Schwarzenegger in California lost when he brought something like this to the public. It's interesting that in Ohio, it was the Democrats who brought a very similar measure to the public, and it also lost. So we think it's the right thing to do, but it's clear that there's a lot of and it's really gutsy of Spitzer to do it and to back it up with a veto threat, which is the thing that can really clarify the thinking and, you know, catch the attention of the people in government. But the next step is to really make sure that the policy comes out in a way without unintended consequences.
Do you think that some kind of clean redistricting, if there is such a thing, in New York State would benefit one party or another? Maybe this state has trended so Democratic over recent years that, you know, our statewide elections tend to come out for the Democrats. The Assembly is already Democratic. The Senate is still Republican, but it's trending more toward Democratic. Maybe it won't matter to the final outcome very much of the state legislature. What do you think?
Well, you know, one of the interesting facts is everyone says, looks at New York and makes the point that you're more likely to die in office than lose your reelection in the legislature, regardless of party. You're right that New York is trending Democratic in many different ways. It used to be that upstate was Republican and the suburbs were Republican and the cities were Democratic and you kind of balanced out. And now it's much more Democratic overall. Yet, for decades, the Senate has been Republican and this Assembly has been Democratic no matter what the political trends were. There may be a partisan impact, but from our perspective, certainly the bigger goal should be that voters actually get a robust democracy in competitive elections. You think about how we in New York and in places like New York grind our teeth that because New York is not a swing state, we don't actually have a presidential campaign mm-hmm. every 4 years. Well, that's the way it is for most state legislative races. There's not much of a campaign and much of a chance for people to really hear both sides.
Right, because the districts are either so Democratic or so Republican because they've been drawn that way to be safe for the incumbents.
Right, but at the same time, you know, I live in New York and so do you, and you'd be pretty hard to find a competitive inter-party district in New York.
Yeah, you're not going to find Democrats and Republicans battling for legislative seats in New York City very much, even after this plan goes through.
That's right.
But I would imagine there would be other parts of the state where some Senate seats, since the Senate is so closely divided now with a few seat edge for the GOP, you know, would be very divided. And how some of those lines are drawn could become some of the hot button issues around Spitzer's plan. In fact, wasn't one of the controversies that killed the Schwarzenegger effort at this that Democrats accused it of being a partisan power grab in sheep's clothing because the kinds of standards that he was setting up that were on paper nonpartisan would actually give the Republicans more of an advantage in California?
Well, you had a situation in California where although the way that legislative districts were drawn tended to favor Democrats more than the state did. And in Ohio, you had a situation where they tended to favor Republicans more than the state's votes would indicate. And it was both in the good government and pro-democracy interest, but also in the partisan interest of one party or another in those states to change it. And so what happened was the voters in California saw what Schwarzenegger was doing in part as a Republican power grab, and the voters in Ohio saw it as a Democratic power grab. And it's one of the – we talked about federalism in the discussion on stem cell. This is something where redistricting for congressional seats, at the very least, happens in every state.
That's an important point to emphasize, I think, that the drawing of congressional district lines takes place at the state level. It's not done by Congress. So, for example, we got that Tom DeLay situation in Texas where he was able to – go and, you know, in mid-decade, even though this is supposed to be done generally once a decade, and redraw the lines of the congressional districts in Texas to favor the Republicans, and that helped the Republicans keep control of Congress in the last election, correct?
Everyone thought it was going to help them keep control of Congress forever and ever, and it turned out that even Tom DeLay's handiwork wasn't strong enough to overcome the real voter tide in this last election. But Tom DeLay engineered a mid-decade redistricting. Remember that the redistricting is supposed to happen every decade after the census. And DeLay just did a mid-decade redistricting just to create more Republican seats. And the Brennan Center for Justice was one of the groups that was part of the team that went to the Supreme Court. We filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief in that case, on the Texas redistricting.
And you lost.
And we lost. And the court said, not our problem. And basically made it possible for states to do mid-decade redistricting for pretty much whatever reason they choose. And so I do think that this is one of the reasons what Spitzer has done is so important, because it New York could just kind of say, well, you know, we're going to do what Tom DeLay did. And for him to instead say we're going to try a better standard and do the right thing and be a leader for the country is you know, very heartening. And it's really it is the applause on the tape that you played. I can only imagine how genuinely enthusiastic it really was. But this is going to be one of the toughest fights and something that people really need to stand up for reform.
You know, I was watching the State of the State address, and it was pretty enthusiastic. In fact, I don't know if you saw it, but the next item that Spitzer mentioned, and I don't even remember what it was, but he was expecting applause after that one, too, and it didn't come. And he looked at the audience, and he said, you applaud for redistricting, but not for that? So maybe that was an indication of how strongly people feel about redistricting.
Well, you know, it's an interesting cusp, because the Republicans in the Senate, perhaps, this might be wishful thinking or fantasizing, but they look at the trend in the voting and see that the Democrats could very much carve the state up a la Tom DeLay, and that they may have the best protection for a system that's nonpartisan. And the Democrats have been pushing this kind of stuff for a while because they have seen gerrymandering is helping protect the Senate majority when the votes weren't there. And there are a lot of really interesting issues on this. One of the things that we've worked on is an anomaly in the law, which is that when you're in prison, and I don't mean you particularly, but when one of us...
I was worried there for a minute. Go ahead.
Should one of us wind up in prison, our vote would... we are counted for the census where we are involuntarily in prison, rather than where we actually come from. And we can't vote, but we're counted for the census for that purpose. So when you think about the huge amount of population upstate who are actually downstate residents in prison, that is all counted in the proportionality for the upstate legislative districts. And this is not just something in New York. This is something we've worked on with the Census Bureau in Washington. Congressman Jose Serrano of the Bronx has been a real leader on it. But it really has a big impact in New York as well, both in the kind of funding levels for government program, but especially in how legislative districts are drawn. There are hundreds of thousands of people in prison who are boosting the vote totals of the rural districts where their prisons are, but they can't vote.
We're just about out of time with Michael Wallman from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. He's the executive director, and he was on Spitzer's transition team, as we have been talking about two more of the many proposals for reform in the Spitzer State of the State address, a stem cell funding initiative, and redistricting reform. And before you go, Michael, is it possible that we've all been too concerned about the district lines being drawn the way they have? Because, you know, we've been talking about this for years with respect to the incumbent protection plan and the way that it polarizes the country further between entrenched Democrats and entrenched Republicans. And yet we see what did happen in this election, which I think we have to say was good for democracy, not because one party or another prevailed, but because despite these attempts at making all these seats safe. When the public was unhappy, power changed hands.
That's true, although it took a massive landslide to change hands. In other words, if you actually look at the percentage of vote that the Democrats and Republicans got, it was not even close. It was a really significant landslide for the Democrats. And there was turnover, but it wasn't so much turnover that it was reflected in the congressional numbers the way the actual votes were. Obviously, what would have been what I was thinking might have happened, and it didn't happen, was that we would wake up the day after Election Day and have this massive landslide, yet Congress didn't change hands, and people would see it as another congressional Florida. But there is a real need for movement forward on several fronts at once to revitalize democracy. And again, using the New York example, Spitzer's State of the State was remarkable in a lot of ways. And I know this just sounds kind of like boilerplate or maybe the emotion of the moment. But as you mentioned, I was Bill Clinton's chief speechwriter, and I've written a lot of these speeches. I wrote 4 State of the Union addresses, the long ones that people remember. And these speeches are hard to do. They're a laundry list.
And you must have been good at it, because I remember on the morning after some of these long Clinton State of the Union addresses, commentators would complain how long it was, and then the television ratings would come in, and people stayed with it the whole hour and 10 minutes.
Well, it was interesting. And in fact, the ratings, the viewership would go up the longer he talked. The public had a thirst for hearing directly from their leaders on public policy without Cokie Roberts and Sam Donaldson telling them why it was all nonsense. And it was the only time that a president got to speak directly to the public anymore. They don't get to order up an Oval Office address the way they used to. And this was, people actually want to hear from their government. They have a latent, maybe a long submerged interest in politics, interest in government. And what Spitzer did with this speech was really quite remarkable. The force with which he emphasized real deep systemic reform, especially at the beginning, not as a throwaway, but as a real challenge, was, I can't remember many things like it.
Well, it was the central organizing principle, and he's got a lot of public goodwill right now, and we'll see how much opposition turns up to particular proposals, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of big fights over a lot of particular things, and we'll be covering them closely here. And Michael Waldman, Executive Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU and a member of the Spitzer Transition Team, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up in a minute, your calls on random acts of kindness in the face of danger. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.